Adams evoked instead prospects of abundance, the return of health, industry, and trade to those cities which have lately been afflicted with disease. Let the grumblers wake up to the brightest, best, and most peaceful days they now see, declared Abigail. Her old delight in being at the center of things had returned in full flower. In unseasonably mild weather, she was out and about taking walks, making calls, receiving visitors, and enjoying the current spectacle of Philadelphia society. For in its last winter as the nation's capital, the city intended to shine. I have heard of once a man and twice a child, and the ladies' caps are an exact copy of babies' caps. Abigail began her report to Mary on gay attire, showing no less delight in details, sleeves, buttons, petticoats, hairstyles, than once she had when writing from Paris. Then, in an instant, the entire mood of the city changed. On December 14th, 1799, as if to give period to the passing of the century and the federal era, George Washington died at Mount Vernon. The cause of death was a heavy cold, a streptococcus infection. He had been 67 and, until a few days before, in good health. The news reached Philadelphia the night of the 17th. In the morning, the muffled bells of Christ Church commenced to toll, and Congress adjourned. The Adamses were stunned. The nation, said the president in a formal message to the Senate, had lost her most esteemed, beloved, and admired citizen. I feel myself alone, bereaved of my last brother. No man was more deservedly beloved and respected, wrote Abigail. A universal melancholy has pervaded all classes of people. The door of the presidential mansion, Congress Hall, Washington's pew at Christ Church were draped in black. In Boston Harbor, every ship displayed the melancholy signal of mortality. Our pulpit is hung with black, Mary Cranch reported from Quincy. The day after Christmas, the official day of mourning in the Capitol, troops of light infantry and cavalry passed through the city to the slow military beat of muffled drums in a grand solemn procession that began at Congress Hall and included a host of federal and state leaders, city magistrates, masons, and a riderless white horse with reversed boots in the stirrups. Washington had been interred in the family vault at Mount Vernon, but this was the nation's funeral for its first president and greatest hero. The line of march was south on Fifth Street, east on Walnut, then north on Fourth, crossing Chestnut, Market, and Arch Streets, to the German Lutheran Church at Fourth and Cherry, which had the largest seating capacity of any church in the city. The President of the United States and his lady and a vast concourse of other citizens were present for services led by Bishop William White of Christ Church, with an oration by Representative Henry Lee of Virginia, General Light Horse Harry Lee, who extolled Washington as first in war, first in peace, first in the hearts of his countrymen. When the service ended after 4.5 hours, several hundred people crowded into the president's house. The gentlemen, all in black, Abigail noted, while the ladies had not let their grief deprive them in their taste for ornamenting. They wore black military sashes, epaulettes of black silk, black plumes, black gloves and fans. But as the encomiums to Washington continued, in speeches, sermons, and editorials, tributes that seemed often as contrived for show as the black plumes and fans, Abigail grew extremely impatient. When a minister at Newburyport, in a rapturous eulogy, spoke of Washington as the savior of the country, she turned indignant. At no time, she wrote, had the fate of the country rested on the breath of one man, not even Washington. Wise and judicious observations about his character are those only which will outlive the badges of mourning, she told Mary. Simple truth is his best, his greatest eulogy. For the time being, the president said no more than he already had. But the vice president was not known to have said anything about Washington. In some quarters, it was being observed that because of his shame over the Matsei letter, Jefferson had deliberately delayed his departure from Monticello to avoid the ceremonies in Washington's memory. Jefferson, who could have been in Philadelphia in time, did not arrive until 2 days later, on December 28th, after an absence of 10 months. "I congratulate you on the new year and the new century," Adams wrote to his old friend Cotton Tufts on January 1st, 1800, adding a line from Virgil, "Auspice venturo laetentur ut omnia." Look how they are full of joy at the age to come. If Adams had any thoughts or feelings about the passing of the epochal 18th century, any observations on the Age of Enlightenment, the century of Johnson, Voltaire, the Declaration of Independence, the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the age of Pitt and Washington, the advent of the United States of America, or if he had any premonitions or words to the wise about the future of his country or of humankind, he committed none to paper. His thoughts, to judge by what he said to Cotton Tufts, were on home, and some marshland he wished to buy, overpriced though it might be. Across the water, events had moved on dramatically. In February came the news from France of a coup on November 9th, 18 Brumaire by the French Revolutionary calendar. General Bonaparte had taken power as first consul, which made him, at age 33, sovereign ruler of France and much of Europe. The French Revolution was over, as declared Bonaparte himself. Jefferson, who had pinned his highest hopes on the revolution, commented only that the situation was painfully interesting. Clearly, American enchantment with France and the Revolution were also at an end. Washington's death had seemed to mark the close of one era. The arrival of Napoleon Bonaparte ushered in another. Adams, who, like Edmund Burke, had predicted dictatorship as the inevitable outcome for the Revolution, wisely kept silent. Electioneering had already begun. A stormy session was forecast, and from the tone of their letters home, to Mary Cranch, Cotton Tufts, and others, both the Adamses seemed to have concluded that there was to be no second term for them. That Jefferson would be the Republican choice to oppose him in the election was a foregone conclusion. Congress was doing little. From the vice president's chair upstairs at Congress Hall, Jefferson lamented the overbearing dreariness of the scene. As much as possible, he was associating with the class of science, as he said, his friends and fellow members of the Philosophical Society, of which he had become president. He took time to have his portrait painted by young Rembrandt Peale, the gifted son of Charles Wilson Peale, and of all the portraits done of him, it was perhaps the strongest. Jefferson in his prime at age 57, gray-haired, handsome, and confident. Acutely conscious of the mistakes Adams had made as vice president, Jefferson, when presiding in the Senate, never talked out of turn or tried to impose his own opinion from the chair, conduct all in keeping with his nature. Moreover, he saw no necessity to be constantly present, as Adams had. There were better ways to spend his time, Jefferson felt. Seeing the need for a manual of parliamentary rules for the Senate, he wrote one, distinguished by its clarity, emphasis on decorum, and the degree to which he had drawn on the British model. Had it been Adams paying such tribute to English foundations and traditions, the uproar would have been immediate. he would have been denounced still again as tainted by his years in London and love for all things British. But among Jefferson's many contributions to the new republic, his Senate Manual would stand as one of the most useful and enduring. In writing one rule, number 17.9, under Order in Debate, it was almost as though he had his predecessor as vice president specifically in mind. No one is to speak impertinently or beside the question, superfluously or tediously. If Adams found any relief or pleasure in his duties, it was approving on April 24th legislation that appropriated $5,900 to purchase such books as may be necessary for a new Library of Congress. It was one of the few measures upon which he and the Vice President could have heartily agreed. Section 4. That the contest for the presidency in 1800 was to be unlike any of the three preceding presidential elections was clear at once. For the first and last time in history, the president was running against the vice president. The two political parties had also come into their own with a vitality and vengeance exceeding anything in the country's experience. Further, under the Sedition Act, anyone openly criticizing the president ran the risk of being fined or sent to prison. Since the first sensational case against Congressman Matthew Spitting Lyon of Vermont, 11 others had been charged and convicted under the law. In one instance, a New Jersey tavern loafer who had done no more than cast aspersions on the president's posterior was arrested, prosecuted, and fined $150. That spring of 1800, the notorious James Callender re-emerged, determined to defeat the wretch Adams, elect his patron Jefferson, and make himself a martyr. Matthew Lyon, after being sentenced to 4 months in a foul Vermont jail, had become a national hero and was overwhelmingly re-elected to Congress. Callender, who had quit Philadelphia, was now working as a Republican propagandist in Richmond, Virginia, with the encouragement and financial support of Jefferson, who at the same time was actively distributing a variety of campaign propaganda throughout the country, always careful to conceal his involvement. "Do not let my name be connected with the business," he advised James Monroe. That Adams was never known to be involved in such activity struck some as a sign of how naive and behind the times he was. In the Richmond Examiner, where he praised Jefferson as an ornament to human nature, Callender assaulted Adams in a series of essays that would soon appear as a book titled The Prospect Before Us. It was the first salvo of the election and a clear sign of the sort of contest it would become. Not satisfied that the old charges of monarchist and warmonger were sufficient, Callender called Adams a repulsive pedant, a gross hypocrite, and, in his private life, one of the most egregious fools upon the continent. Adams was that strange compound of ignorance and ferocity, of deceit and weakness, a hideous, hermaphroditical character which has neither the force and firmness of a man nor the gentleness and sensibility of a woman. "The reign of Mr. Adams," said Callender, "has hitherto been one continued tempest of malignant passions." Once, according to Callender, Adams had become so enraged he tore his wig off, threw it to the floor, and stomped on it. By what species of madness had America submitted to accept such a man as president? The historian will search for those occult causes that induced her to exalt an individual who has neither that innocence of sensibility which incites it to love, nor that omnipotence of intellect which commands us to admire. He will ask why the United States degrades themselves to the choice of a wretch whose soul came blasted from the hand of nature, of a wretch that has neither the science of a magistrate, the politeness of a courtier, nor the courage of a man. Adams's sole objective was to make war on France, Callender asserted. The choice was clear. Adams and war, or Jefferson and peace. To all this, Jefferson gave his approval. Having seen the proof sheets of the new volume, he assured Callender, "Such papers cannot fail to produce the best effects." To no one's surprise, Callender was promptly arrested for inciting the American people against their president. In May, he went on trial in a federal court in Richmond, where the jury returned a verdict of guilty, and he was sentenced to 9 months in jail. But as he and Jefferson expected, it was another victory for the Republicans, just as Matthew Lyon's conviction had been. Adams's far greater concern, meanwhile, was his cabinet. Particularly in his dealings with Pickering and McHenry, tension had been building for months, Adams feeling ever more isolated and certain that their first loyalty was to Hamilton, not him. Reports of ill will within the executive departments appeared in the papers. Adams and Pickering were said to hate each other with the utmost cordiality. The long-overdue showdown came after the Republicans defeated the Federalists in the election of the New York legislature, a crucial election in that it would determine New York's electoral vote for president. It was as if all Adams's troubles, all the pent-up anger and frustration he had had in his dealings with the cabinet, let go in a furious outburst at James McHenry, an incompetent but affable man whom Adams rather liked. On the evening of May 5th, Adams summoned McHenry to the presidential mansion to discuss the appointment of a minor federal official. The discussion was quickly concluded, and McHenry was about to leave, when something he said, or the way he said it, started Adams on the subject of Hamilton and the loss of the New York election. Adams charged McHenry with working secretly with Hamilton to undercut the administration. When McHenry protested, Adams cut him off, saying, "I know it, sir, to be so." Hamilton, said Adams, seething with anger, was an intrigant, a man devoid of every moral principle, a bastard, a foreigner. Then Adams let fly with what to any faithful Hamiltonian was the ultimate insult. Jefferson, Adams declared, was a better man, a wiser one than Hamilton. And furthermore, Jefferson would make a better president. How could McHenry and Pickering presume to know what to do in matters of foreign affairs, Adams went on. How dare they try to suspend the mission to France? And why had he been given no warning that Hamilton would turn up at Trenton? Adams charged McHenry with inept management, of failing to clothe the troops adequately. "You cannot, sir, remain longer in office," Adams declared at last. But then, when McHenry agreed to resign, Adams, his fury spent, said almost in apology, he had always considered McHenry a man of understanding and integrity. McHenry immediately wrote his own account of the scene, copies of which he sent to both Adams and Hamilton. Writing to explain his dismissal to a nephew, McHenry portrayed Adams as actually insane. While Adams's outbursts of temper could be explosive, they never happened in public, always in private confrontations. It was then that he would give to his language the full impress of his vehement will. But never until now was he known to have berated a subordinate, and his regret over the outburst was considerable. Still, nothing he had said was untrue, nor was his anger without justification. In firing McHenry, he had done what he should have done well before this. After a pause of a few days, possibly to cool down, he fired Pickering. This time, there was no unpleasant confrontation. On May 10th, in customary fashion, Adams asked for Pickering's resignation by letter. Almost inconceivably, Pickering refused to comply. In a written response of May 12th, He said he did not feel it his duty to resign and imply that he needed the government salary to subsist. Adams discharged him at once, and the same day named as his new Secretary of War Senator Samuel Dexter of Massachusetts, and as Secretary of State John Marshall, who was now a member of the House of Representatives. Why Adams failed to discharge Oliver Wolcott while cleaning house was never adequately explained. Though Wolcott had been quite as duplicitous and disloyal to Adams as either McHenry or Pickering, he somehow succeeded in winning Adams's trust and would continue as Secretary of the Treasury. Hearing of the dismissals, Alexander Hamilton quickly asked Pickering to search the files at the Department of State for copies of extracts of all such documents as will enable you to explain both Jefferson and Adams. The time had come, Hamilton said, when men of real integrity must unite against all charlatans. The removal of the government from Philadelphia to the new federal city by the Potomac was scheduled to take place in June. The president was to go there himself for a first look as soon as he could get away. But two critical issues required decisions in the weeks that remained. What to do about the temporary army, and what to do about three Pennsylvania German farmers who had been sentenced to hang for treason. The fate of the now useless and unpopular army was settled with remarkably little fuss, showing how greatly times had changed. Adams declared that were it left to him, the army should not exist a fortnight. Both Federalists and Republicans in Congress, seeing no reason why Adams should get the credit, voted to disband the army by summer. Had Hamilton been given free rein with the army, Adams would remark, it would have required a second army to disband the first one. The fate of the condemned men, however, was left to Adams alone. In southeastern Pennsylvania the previous year, there had been an armed uprising by German Pennsylvania Dutch farmers angry over the federal tax on land and the high-handed ways of the federal tax collectors. The rebellion had died down by the time state and federal troops arrived, but its leader, John Freese, and two others were taken captive and tried in federal court. Found guilty of treason and sentenced to hang, they had appealed to the president for a pardon. Adams had been initially incensed at the news of the rebellion. It was he who had ordered the federal troops to the scene, but had since insisted on making his own study of the case. "The issue of this investigation," he wrote, "has opened a train of very serious contemplations to me, which will require the closest attention of my best understanding and will prove a severe trial to my heart." Again, he asked for the opinions of his cabinet officers, all of whom recommended that, to set an example, the sentence should be carried out. Capital punishment was part of life, nor was Adams opposed to it. As president, he had signed death warrants for military deserters. Secretary of State Pickering, in giving his opinion, was, like the others, only expressing what he viewed as a duty of office. "Painful as is the idea of taking the life of a man," Pickering wrote, "I feel a calm and solid satisfaction that an opportunity is now presented in executing the justice of the law to crush that spirit which, if not overthrown and destroyed, may proceed in its career and overturn the government." It was what Adams himself might have written earlier. But with his review completed, Adams saw that he had been mistaken. Freese, it was his judgment, had led a riot, not an insurrection, and was therefore not guilty of treason. Rejecting the verdict of the jury and the unanimous opinion of his cabinet, Adams pardoned Freese and the two others, never doubting he had done the right thing. And though the decision aggravated still further the already infuriated Hamiltonians, who saw it as still one more example of Adams's weakness and capriciousness, much of the electorate approved, and especially in Pennsylvania. If the president and his wife had misgivings about vacating Philadelphia and the great brick mansion on Market Street, if they were at all saddened by the prospect, such feelings went unrecorded. In her last letters to Mary Cranch before leaving, Abigail wrote mainly of the lovely spring weather, as luxuriant a season as I ever knew, and the arrangements to be made for a final dinner party. She started for Quincy on May 19th. The president departed for Washington on May 27th, heading southwest in his coach and four, accompanied by Billy Shaw and escorted by the ever-faithful John Breisler on horseback. For miles through Pennsylvania's Lancaster County, where well-tended farms were burgeoning with crops in the luxuriant season, Adams delighted in the scenery. At Lancaster and later at Frederick, Maryland, he spoke before public gatherings and was warmly received, as he was at other towns along the way, enjoying what in that day and age passed for campaigning. Such were the tributes and entertainments in his honor en route. It was not until June 3rd that he reached the boundary line of the 10-mile square of the District of Columbia. Given what there was to see, Adams might have been terribly disappointed by the federal city. He could rightfully have fumed over the heat, the mosquitoes, the squalid shacks of the work crews, or the projected cost of the project, or the questionable real estate ventures that had failed year after year despite so many grand promises. Another nephew, William Cranch, had become involved in one such scheme and gone bankrupt. Being that it was his first foray into the South, Adams might have been disturbed by the sight of slaves at work. For all the talk, there was no city as yet. Only a rather shabby village and great stretches of tree stumps, stubble, and swamp. There were no schools, not a single church. Capitol Hill comprised a few stores, a few nondescript hotels and boarding houses, clustered near a half-finished sandstone capitol. To accommodate the different departments of the government, only one structure had been completed, the Treasury, a plain two-story brick building a mile to the west of the Capitol, next door to the new President's House, which was still a long way from being ready. Oliver Wolcott, in a letter to his wife, described the Capitol and the President's House as magnificent, yet was astounded at how much had still to be done. "I cannot but consider our presidents as very unfortunate men if they must live in this dwelling. It must be cold and damp in winter. It was built to be looked at by visitors and strangers, and will render its occupants an object of ridicule with some and pity with others." Dr. William Thornton, a commissioner of the district and architect of the Capitol, spoke confidently of a population in Washington of 160,000 people within a few years. To Wolcott, as to many, it seemed no one in Washington knew what he was talking about. In fact, it would be nearly 80 years before the city had such a population. Adams, with his memories of Paris and London, with his fondness for Philadelphia, and his belief that the capital of a great nation ought to be a great city, could have been appalled by the whole place and seen it as a colossal blunder. He could have dismissed it as Jefferson's city, Jefferson having devoted more time and thought to the project than anyone in government. Everything considered, there was almost no reason for Adams to have liked anything about it. Yet, by all signs, he was quite pleased. "I like the seat of government very well," he wrote Abigail. He stayed 10 days, lodging at Tunnicliffe City Hotel near the Capitol. He was joined by his new appointments, Secretary of State Marshall and Secretary of War Dexter, who with the rest of the executive branch had made the move from Philadelphia, along with the complete files of the president and the departments shipped in 8 packing cases. Adams made a brief inspection of the new president's house. Once, when asked by Washington how he thought a president ought to live, in what manner and style, Adams had said it should be in a fairly grand way. And though he had said nothing specific about the sort of house a president should have, this under construction seems to have met his approval. He imagined himself asleep there or lying awake, he told Abigail, but referred only to the coming winter, not the next 4 years. He enjoyed most of all his visits to Mount Vernon to call on Martha Washington, and to Alexandria, where he was acclaimed by the townspeople and given a dinner in his honor at the home of Attorney General Lee, the net effect of which was to make him extremely homesick. Oh, that I could have a home! He felt he had been forever on the move, on the road. Rolling, 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 till I am very nearly rolling into the bosom of Mother Earth. By first light, June 14th, he was rolling north to Quincy, leaving John Marshall to manage in his absence. Section 5. In the summer and fall of 1800, the question of who was to lead the nation rapidly became a contest of personal vilification surpassing any presidential election in American history. The spirit of party had taken hold with a vengeance, and whether Adams or Jefferson was the most abused would be hard to say. In Federalist pamphlets and newspapers, Jefferson was decried as a hopeless visionary, a weakling, an intriguer intoxicated with French philosophy, more a Frenchman than an American, and therefore a bad man. He was accused of favoring states' rights over the Union, charged with infidelity to the Constitution, called a spendthrift and libertine. One New York paper assured its readers that a Jefferson victory would mean civil war. Hordes of Frenchmen and Irishmen, the refuse of Europe, would flood the country and threaten the life of all who love order, peace, virtue, and religion. It was said Jefferson had swindled clients as a young lawyer. The old smear of cowardice during his time as governor of Virginia was revived. But most amplified were charges of atheism. Not only was Jefferson a godless man, but one who mocked the Christian faith. In New England, word went out that family Bibles would have to be hidden away for safekeeping were he elected. So widespread and pervasive was such propaganda that even Martha Washington, who may have been smarting still from the Muttsay letter, remarked to a visiting clergyman that she thought Jefferson one of the most detestable of mankind. Stories were spread of personal immorality. It was now that a whispering campaign began, to the effect that all Southern slave masters were known to cohabit with slave women, and that the sage of Monticello was no exception. Adams was inevitably excoriated as a monarchist, more British than American, and therefore a bad man. He was ridiculed as old, addled, and toothless. Timothy Pickering spread the rumor that to secure his re-election, Adams had struck a corrupt bargain with the Republicans. According to another story, this secret arrangement was with Jefferson himself. Adams was to throw the election Jefferson's way and serve as Jefferson's vice president. If Jefferson carried on with slave women, Adams, according to one story in circulation, had ordered Charles Cotesworth Pinckney to London to procure 4 pretty mistresses to divide between them. When the story reached Adams, he was highly amused. "I do declare upon my honor," he wrote William Tudor, "if this is true, General Pinckney has kept them all for himself and cheated me out of my 2. Most vicious were the charges that Adams was insane. Thus, if Jefferson was a Jacobin, a shameless Southern libertine, and a howling atheist, Adams was a Tory, a vain Yankee scold, and, if truth be known, quite mad. But the great difference in the attacks on Adams in this election was that they came from Republicans and high Federalists alike. While the Republicans assaulted him as a warmonger, he was berated by the high Federalists as faint-hearted in the face of the French. While one side belittled him as a creature of the Hamiltonians, The other scorned him as a friend of Elbridge Gerry. Jefferson, in his 4 years as vice president, had so effectively separated himself from Adams and the administration that he could be held accountable for nothing that had disappointed, displeased, or infuriated anyone. Whereas Adams was held forever accountable for the new taxes, the Alien and Sedition Acts, the Standing Army, and a host of other menaces, as said Philadelphia's Aurora. There were as well striking ironies. Jefferson, the Virginia aristocrat and slave master, who lived in a style fit for a prince, as removed from his fellow citizens and their lives as it was possible to be, was hailed as the apostle of liberty, the man of the people. Adams, the farmer's son, who despised slavery and practiced the kind of personal economy and plain living commonly upheld as the American way, was scorned as an aristocrat, who, if he could, would enslave the common people. "My countrymen," exclaimed William Duane in the Aurora in his crusade for Jefferson, "if you have not virtue enough to stem the current, determine to be slaves at once." For Adams, abuse from the Jefferson Republicans was an old story. It was to be expected. Far more hurtful were the personal attacks from the Hamilton Federalists. When Oliver Wolcott wrote from his office in Washington to tell Fisher Ames of Massachusetts that he would work to defeat Adams, and that between Adams and Jefferson there was scarcely a difference, that one would be as disastrous as the other, he was only expressing what many Hamilton Federalists had concluded, taking their cue from their leader. For again, as in 1788 and 1796, Hamilton was throwing his weight into the contest to tip the balance against Adams. Except this time, there was no pretense of secrecy. As early as May, Hamilton had launched a letter campaign to his high Federalist coterie, declaring Adams unfit and incapable as president, a man whose defects of character were guaranteed to bring certain ruin to the party. "If we must have an enemy at the head of the government, let it be one whom we can oppose, who will not involve our party in the disgrace of his foolish and bad measures." On a tour of New England, ostensibly to bid farewell to his army before it disbanded, Hamilton spent as much time as possible among local Federalist leaders, to whom he spread the same charge against Adams. Hamilton's scheme was to make Charles Cotesworth Pinckney president. Reports of Hamilton's activities inevitably reached Quincy. It was soon understood that his visit was merely an electioneering business, to feel the pulse of the New England states and impress those upon whom he could have any influence to vote for Pinckney, Abigail wrote. But by such intrigues, she was sure, the little cock-sparrow general would lose more votes for Pinckney than he would gain. When such an old friend as Francis Dana turned his back on Adams, it was extremely painful for him. Yet he himself and his efforts for peace were widely approved in New England, as Hamilton discovered to his dismay. While strong-minded men stood ready to support Pinckney, Hamilton wrote in his analysis of the political climate, there was still in the body of that people a strong attachment to Adams. As Abigail observed in mid-August, not a public event or levee took place without being attended by many persons who never before came, and never were they so full and so crowded as they have been this season. Meanwhile, local Republicans were noticeably uncritical. As handsome a tribute as any to Adams appeared in the Washington Federalist. In answer to late attempts to undervalue the president, readers were reminded that Adams stood among the few surviving steady, tried patriots whose services to the country were of a kind almost beyond compare. Bred in the old school of politics, his principles are founded on the experience of ages and bid defiance to French flippancies and modern crudities. Always great, and though sometimes alone, all weak and personal motives were forgotten in public energy and the security of the sacred liberties of his country. Deeply versed in legal lore, profoundly skilled in political science, joined to the advantage of 40 years' unceasing engagement in the turbulent and triumphant scenes, both at home and in Europe, which have marked our history, learned in the language and arts of diplomacy, more conversant with the views, jealousies, resources, and intrigues of Great Britain, France, and Holland than any other American, alike aloof to flattery and vulgar ambition. As above all undue control, he has as his sole object the present freedom and independence of his country and its future glory. On this solid basis, he has attempted to raise a monument of his honest fame. With reports from the Peace Commission, maddeningly thin and long delayed, the issue of peace and war remained foremost almost to the end. What the Aurora would proclaim at the close of the campaign was no different from what James Callender had written in early spring. "With Jefferson we shall have peace. The friends of war will vote for Adams." The two candidates conveyed the customary air of indifference, neither saying anything publicly or appearing to lift a finger in his own behalf. Jefferson remained at Monticello, Adams at his farm, which he had lately taken to calling Stonyfield instead of Peacefield, perhaps feeling the new name was more in keeping with New England candor, or that it better defined the look of the political landscape at the moment. He devoted himself almost entirely to official duties, maintaining steady correspondence with Secretary Marshall in particular. Nothing mattered more, over nothing did Adams fret more, than the state of negotiations in France. And still, there was no word. The great imponderable was Napoleon Bonaparte. "I cannot account for the long delay of our envoys," wrote Marshall, who had begun to have doubts and reminded the president that there must be no sacrifice of American honor to please the First Consul. "We ought not be surprised if we see our envoys without a treaty," he warned, "and this could produce a critical state of things." But Adams needed no reminding. In reply, he advised prudent preparations for war in the event of another rebuff. "I am much of your opinion that we ought not to be surprised," he told Marshall on September 4th. "The government ought to be prepared to take a decided part. Questions of consequence will arise, and among others, whether the president ought not at the opening session to recommend an immediate and general declaration of war against the French Republic. We have had wonderful proofs that the public mind cannot be held in a state of suspense. The public opinion, it seems, must always be a decided one, whether in the right or not. I wish the heads of departments to turn their thoughts to the subject and view it in all its lights." For his part, Jefferson appeared to be devoting his time at Monticello to rural interests only. Both Abigail and John enjoyed comparatively good health, and Adams's love of home, his everyday delight in his farm, were as constant as ever, no less than what Washington had felt for Mount Vernon or Jefferson for Monticello. But as Abigail confided in family correspondence, her own and the president's private days and frequent sleepless nights were deeply troubled by the sad fate of their alcoholic son. On her way home from Philadelphia in early November, Abigail had stopped again at Eastchester, where this time she saw Charles himself. "The whole man is so changed that ruin and destruction have swallowed him up," Abigail confided to John Quincy. "Poor, poor, unhappy, wretched man," she wrote, her heart breaking. Charles's wife had gone with her younger child to stay with her mother, while Abigail had brought the other child, 4-year-old Susanna, home to Quincy. So with Nabby and her daughter Caroline again spending the summer, it was a full house. Nothing she had been able to say to Charles had had any effect, Abigail wrote. She had tried remonstrances. She had reminded him of all that was dear in life: honor, reputation, family, friends. But all is lost on him. She and the president would provide for his family. Yet I am wounded to the soul by the consideration of what is to become of him. What will be his fate embitters every moment of my life. At age 30, Charles seemed beyond saving. On Monday, October 13th, Adams set off by coach from Quincy on the journey back to Washington. His own heartbreak over Charles was no less than what Abigail suffered, as his later writings disclose. But he had not softened in his decision to renounce his son. Passing through Eastchester, Adams did not stop to see him, as Abigail would, he knew, when she followed later, resolved to be with John in Washington, whatever lay in store. The greetings he received along the way were of a kind to help his sagging spirits. Clearly, he stood well with the large majority of the Federalist Party, and a great many more besides, who saw him as a staunch old patriot carrying on in the tradition of Washington. John Adams, it was said, was a good husband, a good father, a good citizen, and a good man. He was a peacemaker, whatever the Hamiltonians might say, and the American people did not hold that against him. Republicans, too, were expressing new regard, even affection, for Adams. The Jacobins professed to admire and respect the independence of Mr. Adams's character, Thomas reported from Philadelphia to his mother, and several of them have told me that next to their idol Jefferson, they would definitely prefer him to any man in the country. But this did not mean they would vote for him, and Thomas was pessimistic. "I am glad you are to be with my father this winter," he told her. "The prospect is dreary enough, not for him, but for the country." Then, without warning, while Adams was on the road to Washington, a thunderbolt struck. Since summer, Alexander Hamilton had been working on a letter intended initially for a select few Federalists in several states. Timothy Pickering, James McHenry, and Oliver Wolcott had all been recruited to help. Pickering and McHenry had supplied what confidential information they could from past experience in Adams's cabinet, while Wolcott, still a member of the cabinet, continued to have access to confidential files. But when asked for their views on Hamilton's initial draft of the letter, most of them were astonished and urged Hamilton not to put his name on it. Wolcott suggested that it not be released at all because, he wrote, "the poor old man was quite capable of doing himself in without help from anyone else." But Hamilton paid no attention. Not long past, Abigail had warned Adams to beware of that spare Cassius. Now, in the 11th hour of the election, Hamilton lashed out in a desperate effort to destroy Adams, the leading candidate of his own party. A letter from Alexander Hamilton concerning the public conduct and character of John Adams, Esquire, President of the United States, a 54-page pamphlet, was published in New York at the end of October. Nothing that Hamilton ever wrote about Jefferson was half so contemptuous. He berated Adams in nearly every way possible. For his great intrinsic defects of character, his disgusting egotism, weaknesses, vacillation, his eccentric tendencies, his bitter animosity toward his own cabinet. He deplored Adams's handling of relations with France, the precipitate nomination of William Vans Murray, the firing of Timothy Pickering, the pardoning of John Freeze. Though Hamilton did not go so far as to call Adams insane, he cited his ungovernable temper as evidence of a man out of control. "It is a fact that he is often liable to paroxysms of anger which deprive him of self-command and produce very outrageous behavior." Yet Hamilton made no charges of corruption or misconduct on Adams's part. He even acknowledged Adams's patriotism and integrity, and conceded, without getting specific, that Adams had talents of a certain kind. And finally, most strangely, having spent 50 pages tearing Adams to pieces, Hamilton concluded by saying Adams must be supported equally with General Pinckney in the election. Republicans were euphoric. Whatever crazed notions had taken hold of Hamilton, he had surely dealt Adams a blow and rent the Federal Party in twain. In a high-spirited letter to Jefferson, James Madison said Hamilton's thunderbolt meant certain victory for Jefferson. "I rejoice with you that republicanism is likely to be so completely triumphant." Federalists everywhere were aghast, disbelieving, or seething with anger. In Connecticut, Noah Webster produced a pamphlet accusing Hamilton of extreme disloyalty and ambition to become the American Caesar. By contrast to Hamilton, Webster wrote, Adams was a man of pure morals, of firm attachment to Republican government, of sound and inflexible patriotism. Were Jefferson to be elected, Webster wrote to Hamilton, the fault will lie at your door, and your conduct on this occasion will be discerned little short of insanity. In fact, Hamilton had amply demonstrated that it was he who had become a burden to the party. He, if anyone, who seemed to have departed from his senses. Speculation as to why he had done it, what possible purpose he might have had, would go on for years. Possibly, as John Quincy surmised, it was because Adams had denied him his chance for military glory, humiliated him at Trenton, and made his army superfluous. Perhaps he believed he was improving Pinckney's chances, or he wanted to bring down the Federalist Party, so that in the aftermath of a Jefferson victory, he could raise it up again as his own creation. Probably not even Hamilton knew the answer. But by his own hand, he had ruined whatever chance he ever had for the power and glory he so desperately desired. For several days toward the end of October, plasterers and painters at work on the President's House in Washington, as well as the commissioners of the District of Columbia, had been keeping an eye out for the President, not knowing just when he might appear. With the imponderables of travel, no one's arrival could be predetermined or planned for precisely, not even a president's. The immense house was still unfinished. It reeked of wet plaster and wet paint. Fires had to be kept blazing in every fireplace on the main floor to speed up the drying process. Only a twisting back stair had been built between floors. Closet doors were missing. There were no bells to ring for service. And though the furniture had arrived from Philadelphia, it looked lost in such enormous rooms. Just one painting had been hung. A full-length portrait of Washington in his black velvet suit by Gilbert Stuart, which had also been sent from Philadelphia. The house stood in a weedy, wagon-rutted field with piles of stone and rubble about. It all looked very raw and unkempt. Yet the great whitewashed stone building, the largest house in America, as large as the half of the Capitol that had been erected, was truly a grand edifice, noble even in its present state. At midday Saturday, November 1st, Commissioners William Thornton and Alexander White were inspecting the main floor when, at 1 o'clock, the President was seen rolling up to the south entrance in his coach and four. He was accompanied still by Billy Shaw and Breisler following on horseback. There was no one else, no honor guard, no band playing, no entourage of any kind. The two commissioners and a few workers at hand comprised the welcoming committee for the arrival of John Adams, the first president to occupy what only much later would become known as the White House. An office was made ready in an ample room with a southern exposure on the second floor, next door to what was to be Adams's bedroom. Secretaries Marshall and Stoddart, the two in the cabinet Adams counted on, came to pay their respects. Later, supper finished, he climbed the back stairs, candle in hand, and retired for the night. At his desk the next morning, on a plain sheet of paper, which he headed President's House, Washington City, November 2, 1800, he wrote to Abigail a letter in which he offered a simple benediction. "I pray heaven to bestow the best of blessings on this house and all that shall hereafter inhabit. May none but honest and wise men ever rule under this roof." But for Adams, the house was to be the setting of great disappointment and much sorrow. By the time he wrote to Abigail again, he had seen the Hamilton pamphlet and concluded, as Madison had, that it meant his certain defeat. "The ancients thought a great book a great evil," he told her. "Mr. H. will find a little book an evil great enough for him, for it will ensure the choice of the man he dreads or pretends to dread more than me." To judge by what he said privately in a letter to a friend, he took the blow with notable equanimity. Like others, he thought Hamilton had succeeded mainly in damaging himself. He was not Hamilton's enemy, Adams wrote, and Hamilton was not without talent. "There is more burnish, however, on the outside than sterling silver in substance." But this was as much as he would say, at least while president. At the end of the first week in November, Adams's long wait for news from France ended. The mission had succeeded. A treaty with France, the Convention of Montfontaine, had been signed on October 3, 1800, at a chateau north of Paris. At a grand fête celebrating the event, Bonaparte declared that the differences between France and the United States had been no more than a family quarrel. Gifts were presented to the American envoys, toasts raised to perpetual peace between the two nations. The first report appeared in a Baltimore paper on November 7th. Another month would pass before the official copy of the convention arrived in Washington, at which point it would be submitted to the Senate for approval. The news had come too late to affect the election, but peace had truly been achieved. Though Adams could say nothing of it yet, the quasi-war was over, and for Adams it was an immense victory. Abigail reached Washington on November 16th, at the end of an extremely arduous journey. Stopping to see Charles at East Chester, she was stunned to find him desperately ill in the care of Nabby. Abigail had had no forewarning. No one had been told, because his condition had come on so rapidly. Sitting by his bedside, she sensed she was seeing him for the last time. When she left, she again took Susanna with her for the rest of the journey. In Maryland, as she later described it to Mary Cranch, there was only forest, the roads so rough and uncertain that she and her party were lost for 2 hours. "But woods are all you see from Baltimore until you reach the city, which is only so in name." She thought the president's house, beautifully situated by the Potomac, the country around, romantic but wild. Nearby Georgetown, however, was "the very dirtiest hole I ever saw." The house, she told Mary in a letter of November 21st, was twice as large as the meeting house at home. "It is habitable by fires in every part, 13 of which we are obliged to keep daily or sleep in wet and damp places." The great unplastered audience room at the east end of the main floor she made her drying room to hang out the laundry. There were many who would have refused to live in the house in the state it was in, but the Adamses made do without complaint. The great castle, Abigail knew, had been built for ages to come. She judged it would require 30 servants to run it properly. As it was, she had 6, including John and Mary Briesler. She had not liked what little she had seen of the South thus far. The presence of slaves working about the house left her feeling depressed. The whole system struck her as woefully slow and wasteful, not to say morally wrong. She had watched 12 slaves, clothed in rags at work outside her window, hauling away dirt and rubble with horses and wagons, while their owners stood by doing nothing. 2 of our hardy New England men would do as much work in a day as the whole 12, she told Cotton Tufts. But it is true republicanism that drive the slaves half-fed and destitute of clothing, whilst an owner walks about idle, though one slave is all the property he can boast. With the weather turning colder, she found it maddening that with woods everywhere, it was impossible to find a woodcutter to keep the fires going. She despaired that anything could ever be accomplished in such a society. The lower class of whites, she wrote, are a grade below the Negroes in point of intelligence and 10 below them in point of civility. But, she wrote, I shall bear and forbear. On Saturday, November 22nd, Congress convened for the first time in joint session in the unfinished Capitol, and John Adams delivered what he knew to be his last speech as president. I congratulate the people of the United States on the assembling of Congress at the permanent seat of their government, he began. And I congratulate you, gentlemen, on the prospect of a residence not to be changed. As he had privately for the president's house, he now publicly offered a benediction for the Capitol, the Federal District, and the city of Washington. It would be unbecoming the representatives of this nation to assemble for the first time in this solemn temple without looking up to the supreme ruler of the universe and imploring his blessing. May this territory be the residence of virtue and happiness. In this city, may that piety and virtue, that wisdom and magnanimity, that constancy and self-government which adorned the great character whose name it bears, be forever held in veneration. Here and throughout our country may simple manners, pure morals, and true religion flourish forever. The speech that followed was a brief, gracious summation of the State of the Union, notable for its clarity and absence of exaggeration. He praised the officers and men of the discharged temporary army, both for their patriotism and their readiness to return to the station of private citizens. He praised the Navy and recommended further measures for a defensive naval force. While our best endeavors for the preservation of harmony with all nations will continue to be used, the experience of the world and our own experience admonish us of the insecurity of trusting too confidently to their success. We cannot, without committing a dangerous imprudence, abandon those measures of self-protection which are adapted to our situation, and to which, notwithstanding our pacific policy, the violence of injustice of others may again compel us to resort. Because he had still to receive official word of the negotiations with France, he said only that it was hoped that American efforts for an accommodation would meet with a success proportioned to the sincerity with which they have so often been repeated, which was as close as he came to speaking of his own persistent efforts. He spoke of the need for amending the judiciary system and congratulated the Congress for the revenue that year, the largest of any year thus far. We find reason to rejoice at the prospect which presents itself, he said at the last. The country was prosperous, free, and happy, thanks to the protection of laws emanating only from the general will and the fruits of our own labor. Shortly after, in reply to the then customary answer to his speech from the Senate, Adams said of the new capital, "Here may the youth of this extensive country forever look up without disappointment, not only to the monuments and memorials of the dead, but to the examples of the living." Less than 2 weeks later, on or about December 3rd, the same day the electors convened, a post rider arrived at the president's house with a letter from Eastchester. Charles was dead. He had died on November 30th, of dropsy, it was said, but most likely of cirrhosis as well. "His constitution was so shaken," Abigail wrote to her sister Mary, "that his disease was rapid, and through the last part of his life dreadfully painful and distressing. He bore with patience and submission his sufferings, and heard the prayers for him with composure. His mind at times was much deranged. He was no man's enemy but his own. He was beloved in spite of his errors." To Charles's widow, Abigail wrote, "I would to God I could administer to you that comfort which I stand in need of myself." In his early life, she recalled, no child was ever so tender and amiable. "The president sends his love to you, and mourns, as he has for a long time, with you." In another few days, the outcome of the election was known. Adams had lost. "My little bark has been overset in a squall of thunder and lightning and hail, attended by a strong smell of sulfur," he wrote to Thomas.